explosion, and the reason that I use that term is because it fit on a sign. And you have to think of a title, so I put that, but it's really not going to be about the knowledge explosion exclusively, although that's part of it. What I intend to do today is to give you a report on a National Science Foundation conference that was held in June. It was their contribution to the bicentennial. In fact, it was a series of three conferences on knowledge. Project Knowledge 2000 was the name of the conference, and the idea was to try to look at the probably the largest revolution that's going to occur to us in the history of man in the next 20 to 24 years, and at least that's what all the experts say. So first of all, a little caveat, most of the things I say here I don't necessarily believe or necessarily was involved in. I'm going to be reporting on what the synthesis of the conference was. So I'll say some things that I may or may not believe in, and we can talk about them later. The style I'd like to use is give you a report on a few things and then discuss how you feel about some of the issues. They're very important issues. This could be, in all the things that are facing us, maybe the most critical. If you had to pick one most critical thing, this seems to be, at least the National Science Foundation thought it was the most critical thing coming at us. A lot of things being written about it, and it encompasses almost everything that we do. And it can create very severe problems. It can also be a real challenge in solving the problems we have. First of all, I'd like to introduce myself. Hello, Dave. We have to quit by 12:30 because there's a meeting. We can't go to 1 o'clock today, right? Okay. But anyway, my name is Dick Connor. I work for Control Data Corporation. I'm in education right now, and I've done a lot of things involved in social problems, usually trying to apply new technology to the solution of problems. I'm not a hardware person. I guess I'd be concerned more, called more a software person, but I'm not even really that. I'm concerned with the application of any kind of technology or any new idea to the solving primarily social problems. That's where my interest comes, and you might see that as you go through. I'd like to progress like this. First of all, I'll tell you a little bit about the conference. We, a group of us, about 150 people, were invited to a large center in Leesburg, Virginia. Xerox Corporation has about the largest training facility that I have ever seen. It's just huge. And they lent that to the National Science Foundation, and we all showed up on a Sunday evening. And we began to work immediately. It was one of these conferences where you worked almost 24 hours around the clock. And it was very, very well done in terms of the technical aspects. We were given a topic. Every morning we would get up, and they briefed us before, and we read some materials the night before, part of which I want to read to you. I'll read a few things about what the National Science Foundation and some people think the future could be like. So I'd like to paint the scenario of the future. Many of you have heard this before. I'll just sort of do it again, because it's kind of fun to look at how it could be. And then the next day we got up, had breakfast quickly, and broke up into 5 or 6 groups. There were some industrialists there, or business types. There were governmental types, or teachers, educators, social reformers. All had different groups. And we watched a televised panel discussion of 5 supposedly knowledgeable experts in the field of the question in the morning. Then our groups would meet all morning. We'd discuss the question. We'd pick a person from our group. They'd go in the afternoon, sit down in front of the television cameras. We'd all sit back in all the rooms and watch them discuss the issue. Then we go back in the afternoon, discuss it again. We were just beat it to death. And then in the evening, the people from our groups and the panelists would get together and argue. And we'd watch that on television until about 10 o'clock and then discuss it. Did that 3 days in a row. The process is interesting. It's a videotape kind of process, and it wasn't interactive. We couldn't talk back. We had to listen. And that drove a lot of people bananas. They had to just sit there and listen. And in fact, it was surprising. About 5 people left at the end of the first day. They just couldn't stand the process. They said, there's no structure, and I didn't believe that. I think it's because they couldn't talk back, and they wanted to get at it. And there was just, and that was really a problem. So if you ever get involved in a process, you have to really make sure there's more chance for interaction than something that. It was very unstructured, and it bothered me. Because I didn't know what they were trying to do. And that, you know, people like structure. And at the beginning of the second day, I immediately got up and drew a chart. And I said, we've got to structure our discussion around this. And they all threw me out, and they kept on going. But I've got that chart here. I'm going to show it to you anyway. Because I thought it kind of captured the whole conference all by itself. And I have to get things down into a very simple thing in order to understand them. And that's the way this whole thing will be this morning, a rather simple explanation. Not any complex issues. The solutions may be hard. Let me just read you a little bit about the future. Now, first of all, I'd like to tell you about some of the people who were on the panelists. There were some very, very interesting people. I think maybe the best known, depending on what circles you're in, was a fellow from France, Jean-Louis Servan-Schreiber. I don't know how, I could never pronounce it. He got on the Concorde in the morning, flew over, landed at Dulles, drove over to our place, gave a speech, and then took off and was back in time for dinner in the evening. And we figured, well, it's getting closer to the year 2000 all the time. Just came in and out and did some business in the evening. But we had people like, a professor of psychiatry from the University of Michigan, a professor of human development at Harvard University. And some of these guys were really controversial. People got very angry at what they said. A senior scientist of RCA Corporation has been involved in all the breakthroughs that RCA ever did. So he really has an interesting history of the way technology has occurred. And he was a very, very interesting guy. We had a special correspondent from the Christian Science Monitor. There was a group from the church that came. National Council of Senior Citizens was represented. The president of Smith College, which is a very carefully controlled institution in terms of change. They haven't changed, and they don't want to. They want to preserve. The Illinois State Superintendent of Education was a panelist. A fellow named Douglas Cater, who is from the Aspen Institute on Humanistic Studies, which is a little bit, I think, like Holden. I've never been there. Maybe some of you have. He was a spectacular guy. Head of Antioch College. So we had those kinds of people. We'd toss an issue out to them, and they'd start going, and they'd just bang back and forth for about an hour. And so let me go back and just read to you a few of the things that was background material. It's interesting because it's someone else other than me telling what they think the future may be. And they thought this through apparently very carefully. There's an article, and this is the July Smithsonian issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. I've been quoting from every article in here. It's not that I really tout it. In fact, some of them I think are very interesting in terms of propaganda. This may be too. And the title is, So You Think That TV is Hot Stuff. He says, Just You Wait. And then the subtitle is, Developments in Telecommunications Point the Way to a Wired World with No Need for Commuting or Shopping at the Supermarket. And that turns everybody on. You've heard all this stuff. Okay, don't look now, but your television set is about to be replaced by something more up-to-date. As with many giant steps in technology, it will involve ideas that science fiction people have been picturing for decades, and in fact, for a century or so. In fact, it's rather interesting. A guy back in 1880 was conjuring up the picture of people shopping by television. A long time ago. This is not just a new idea. And he thought it was very practical, and they'd be doing it by the year, I think, 1900. He was a little bit short, but, time goes by. Your television set, your stereo, your telephone are quite primitive tom-toms compared to what's now possible. And the factor behind all of this is, in their minds, I don't necessarily agree yet, I don't know much about it, is a thing called optical fiber. It's the system that we have today of communicating and transporting communication ideas back and forth are over-the-air television, and it's not doing too well. But the optical fiber is a thing about the size of a violin string, and laser beams can travel through it. And it can carry an incredible number of messages both ways. When it says you combine the virtuosity of this miracle with those of computers and satellites and cassettes and all that kind of things, the telecommunications revolution, it would seem, is here. But that remains to be seen, too. We may talk about that. What its social implications may be is not clear. And interestingly enough, the people that were there ended up talking not very much about what we can do, but the social implications. And that made me feel good, because the businessmen's group that I was in, they spent all their concern after the first half day was, wow, this thing is really dangerous, and how can we do something to make sure that it gets used properly, which I'll tell you about later. There are less optimistic opinions about how to get the thing going, but let's picture the way this would look. On one wall of your room in your house will be a large telescreen. It will be able to bring you a wide range of images and sounds and data via push-button controls. In the first place, you can summon up current events and drama offerings and game shows and athletic contests, not unlike the current television choices that you have now. But you may also decide to see a classic film, which a computerized switching system can call forth from an archive. Or you may decide to take a university course prepared and stored in an electronic repository. I was at a conference earlier this year where they were projecting that you'll have a machine like a television set, and a thing about the size of a pack of cigarettes would be a memory that would contain several university courses, and you take it down to the public library and charge it up, and you'd have all the updates, and it'd cost you a quarter. I think they must have been talking at least 2,000, but maybe not. The technology's here. They've done it. It's just making it cheap enough. Or you, let me see, you, when you're ready to take an exam, you can take the questions and you can even get your grades back if you want to, and they'll be recorded in a data bank somewhere. For intensive study, you may want some information on paper rather than the screen, and it'll print it out, which is rather common practice today. Your income tax forms may reach you in the same way. And here the author puts in a little political comment, unless that primitive system is abolished for an entirely new system. I don't think these guys are supposed to do that, but they did. Your daily newspapers may reach you in the same way. Instead of conversing with a computer, you may want to talk to a human being, and here they get into things that Bell has been trying to do for years, where you can call up your daughter in St. Louis and get her on the telescreen and talk to her. There's all of a sudden a great deal of emerging interest in that kind of thing in business, where you can carry on conversations and meetings with people all over the world. But what they're more interested in is being able to have a meeting but not having to meet at the same time, so that when you want to talk about an issue, you can look at the issue, discuss, record your answers and your thoughts into a device, and then somebody else somewhere else, you're in maybe in Minnesota where I am, and somebody else is in California, they could pick it up 4 hours later and react to that, and there's some techniques coming on that may really, really revolutionize the way that meetings and that people communicate. One of the most irrational of modern log jams here, they're politicizing again. The postal system may also yield to tomorrow's telecommunications. And the telescreen engineer sees every home or office as a terminal. And most of my friends that are involved in this, and I have a lot of them that are doing these things and trying to develop the terminals, really feel that by 1980, most of us will have access to a device in the home that is a really sophisticated device over which you can do all these things. These are the hardware people, and there's a very hard distinction made in this article a little bit later. They talk about medicine and data banks that will be able to take care of things for insurance firms, banks, law enforcement agencies, health agencies. Access to data banks will be available over long distance via these cables or microwave, which we're using already. And distance won't make any difference. It'll be just as easy to transport and just as cheap to transport at 300 miles as it is 3,000. So, the ingredients of the revolution are with us. Their wider use seems to affect home and office, business, pleasure, information, persuasion, student, teacher, citizen, and the government in ways that may be startling. Then they go on to talk about optical fiber. Whoever wrote this was really turned on by that, and I guess it is quite an innovation. I don't know that much about it, but they're very excited about it. There are other things that we can do. You can increasing communications devices will be adapted to individualize use of by the computer where and when a person wants to use it, which is a very important thing, particularly in education. People will be use machines as an extension of their own capabilities. People will be changed by the emerging technologies. That's a scary thing. That always seems to bother people, and it does me. For the computer promises to make it possible to interrogate an inanimate database with the same ease and success with which we now ask questions of a friend or a colleague. A picture begins to emerge of a society ever more individualized in its interests and tastes. Medicine, all kinds of interesting things there. We could talk about many examples that already exist, and for those of you who live out in this part of the country, you already have probably one of the most advanced telemedicine systems around. At least they're experimenting with it right now. Shoppers' channels, of course, the whole business of a moneyless economy. That is coming on very rapidly. The corporation for which I work just set up a whole division to go chasing after that. Tremendous competition in that business, and we've been into it for a while. Library, newspaper, mail order catalogs, post office, classroom, theater, all these kinds of things will be combined. And it'll be like a highway network where people will be able to use their televisions in sets in a way that they use their personal automobiles. They may be able to select information, education, entertainment that's being generated anywhere around the world at a different time than it was generated. And then this will presumably foster equal social opportunity in the United States. A lot of people say that this is a way of equalizing education. Here's some of the quotes about the history. Now, the guy that wrote this then said, well, I'm not so sure this is going to happen, because you go back in history and you see that people back in 1880 were saying it was going to happen, and it didn't. And then when the radio came out, they were just absolutely convinced in the 20s that this was it. You know, it was going to solve all the social problems. Things like elicit a new national loyalty and produce a more contented citizenry. This is an article written in 1922. The government will be a living thing to its citizens instead of an abstract and unseen force. We should have been talking about that last night. At last, we may have covenants literally openly arrived at, and on and on and on. Now, the question really is, were they wrong or were they just ahead of their time? And nobody really knows yet. And that's actually the case. Nobody really does know. No one knows where we're going with this stuff. A big question is, so that you make life easier for people than it is even today, what are they going to do with their leisure time? Well, they're going to enrich the citizens' life with a vast assortment of video services and packages, entertainment, education, art, culture. And here the author says, that's what the hardware people keep telling everybody. But the software guys, and I'm a software guy, as I mentioned earlier, they kind of shake their head, and they're somewhat baffled by their assignment. I've been in that kind of an assignment for a year, and the more I've been in it, the more baffled I am about how to do all kinds of things in making these things work appropriately. It seems that to software people, that the hardware specialists love smoothly functioning equipment, but they don't love people who are messy and disorganized. I think the jam guards are like that, right? Yeah. And so why else should they devise such scenarios which always seem to eliminate people or at least keep them out of the way at home? I like that one. And finally, hardware emerging from the laboratories is truly miraculous, which is true. Designing the software may prove to be far more difficult, and that's an understatement. And then finally, one very last little sentence, I don't know how it got in here, but it's at the end of the article, which says, will there perhaps be a special channel for approved revolutionary activities? Kind of neat. Okay. Yes. Oh, this whole article is a contradiction. Yeah, oh, that's right. That's why I said those two words very carefully. Approved revolutionary. Let me get into some of the ideas, because they do talk about that, and everybody got concerned. And there's no answers. These are just kind of fun questions to kick around. And as Carol said yesterday, if you really get hung up, you go back and read Romans 5, and it won't bother you anyway. Okay. Here's an interesting thing that's happening that I didn't realize. Over half of our labor force in this country now is already involved in the manipulation of symbols. Over half of the entire labor force. Now, that kind of business doesn't use much energy. We're also being forced, because of this revolution and other things, to find new non-energy-using things for people to do. And some people feel that by the year 2000, most people will be involved in the manipulation of symbols. That can be a secretary, it can be a mathematician, but it's going to be a large, large part of our lives. There are many statements, but one like this: the third century, from now to the year 2076, is likely to be based on the third and the biggest transportation revolution that has ever occurred. I don't know what the other two are, probably the wheel and the automobile or something like that. And that is of telecommunications, which we just read about. Okay, now, a little bit of background, and then I'll go into some of the concepts that came out of this conference, some of the issues. We had met, ours was the third group to meet. One group met in January, and they tackled the issue of what problems are there involved in generating information. And they said, well, we need information to solve social problems, and the technology's got to help. The second conference, which met in March, I think, they said, what kind of information should be generated? And they came up with some things that I didn't understand very well. But our conference, the third one, was supposed to be about the generation of knowledge and what we should generate and try to get people to use. But we ended up being concerned about the total population having an influence on public decisions. That was one of the biggest topics. And individuals' use of knowledge for their own purposes and quality of life. Some of the other implications of the fact that knowledge in the next 24 years is going to explode from 8 to 10 times that we already have. Most people feel pretty good. I don't understand what that all means. I remember hearing about the knowledge explosion back in 1960, and I kept wondering where they're putting it all. and never saw it myself, except that I had to read a lot more journal articles, and I figured if they're going to do that, everyone's going to get hung up on it anyway, and no one's going to use it. But some of the implications we felt is that there's going to be a great deal of confusion. We're going to have to make rapid adjustments, and in our last night's forum, I began to detect that we're backing away from change already. And there's some very interesting things that were said about the pain of change. There's a law called Moorer's Law. I'd never heard of it before, which said that people will accept information in inverse proportion to the amount of pain involved in accepting it or absorbing it. So if there's some information that really is painful to you to assimilate and use, you know, if it really makes you move away from something you believe in or value, or I suppose, I don't know this very well, then you're not likely to use it. And I think that's maybe an extremely important concept. How can we use what we have and all this stuff coming at us to improve, and then how can we prevent all of this from enslaving or destroying us? The last one scared 75% of the people at the conference, for sure. That was what all the dinner talk was about. Okay, now a little background again. The year 2000 really is already here economically. The legislation and all the things that are heading into the next century have already been pretty well dictated. 25 years ahead isn't too far in terms of where our government has already planned to spend its resources. Now, that can be changed, but we're going to have to really change our priorities. It may not be hard to change, but then again, it may. We don't know. Basic question was, how can we provide people with the knowledge they need to participate wisely in decisions that affect them? Okay, now I'd like to show you my model that nobody else really... Well, they like that model, but I don't think it'll be in their report. And it does put it into simple terms. Here we are. There really are three parts to a system. I'll read it if you can't see it. There is a group that are knowledge generators. That's universities, people that are coming up with new knowledge, research. There's a large amount of money spent on that every year. And then there are the people that are the leaders and the funders that cause things to happen in the communication system. And right now, again, I seem to think of the government in terms of generating and funding knowledge. Then over here is the receivers, and there are many kinds of receivers. There are those that are the have-nots, those that can't receive, those that are turned off and don't, those that are really turned on and need information. They're all part of this group. And this represents the communication and transmission of knowledge from the generators to the receivers, and then there's feedback. At least theoretically there's feedback. That's one of the problems. There usually isn't. The users really usually aren't involved in generation. One of the big problems that we discovered, maybe the biggest one, is that even if all this worked well, we got a lot of knowledge generated and got systems set up that we could use to help, you know, to get information to people, there's a big barrier here of all kinds that keep people from using it or receiving it. Some of the barriers to all of this system working well were language problems, which I run into a lot in dealing with other cultures outside the United States or Indian cultures within this country. Distrust and apathy. I would guess that the people in the business group were sensitive to the disenfranchisement or the distrust of institutions, really were concerned with that one. Funding, politics, the access to the system, the overload of the system, and then the capability to receive, and then time lags in the generation and in the receipt of knowledge. So the weakest link is between the receivers and the people that generate it, and many feel that that just isn't working at all. Part of it gets into what we were just talking about again last night. People are turned off by institutions, and no matter what you say in an institution, it may not be received. A serious problem, though, I think, is functional illiteracy. That's one of my personal interests. And people who can't read well or can't understand things well and can't pass driver's exams, for instance, that's one of the tests of functional illiteracy, are going to have a tough time receiving information. But then beyond that, persons have to learn how to decode once they get the information, how to process, how to make decisions appropriately, and how to act effectively. Again, I'll go back to the forum last night. I think that was one of the problems I heard unconsciously being said that, so what? Part of it is I can't use information to get people to do anything about it. And there's a relatively large movement that wants to try to teach an awful lot of people how to use information, not what to do with it, but how to get it and to use it. Teach people how to access and use information. That's got to be a very important concept. professional guy is always going to be able to get the information he needs some way or another, usually. And that's an overstatement, but it's a lot easier for that person than the person who does not have access to the system. The present system that we have for exchanging information is a mess. And everybody agreed with that, the educators, the government people, all of those responsible for the systems, the people from NBC, ABC, all of them said it's a mess. If you turn on your television, you have, you know, literally about three channels that really are effective, and they're all saying the same thing. They're boring, usually. They're all passing out the same information, the same football scores, and the same things that happen somewhere, you know, disasters and things like that. But you can't talk back to them. You don't have interaction. You can't ask questions. There's just no way of finding out can you question the person that said something that you don't necessarily believe? And they're really not available. The present groups have two masters. They're supposed to serve the public, but they also have their own selfish self-interest. And we all decided that when it comes to a decision, it usually goes the latter way. And anyway, the difference between public ownership of these things and governmental is just a facade. The whole thing is so intertwined that it really isn't the private kind of system that we have in this country. Anyway, right now, then, our present society is really characterized by a scarcity of communication systems. It's very difficult for all of us to communicate unless we come together to a place like this. It brings to mind the thought that if we were all in our own homes and wanted to listen to one of the sessions here and had this very inexpensive optical fiber or whatever kind of system, we could sit down at 9:30 and listen to Vespers or whatever, Carol's sermon in the morning. That's all possible if you wanted to do that. Those are the kind of things that they conjure up, the hardware people do. We are shifting to an abundance of channels. Most people believe that this is going to happen, and it's the how and the results that bother them. The optical fiber thing is going to go. Satellite communications are already here. I mentioned to you that here in Washington, there's a thing called WISC. That's why I said Wisconsin. It's Washington, Idaho, Alaska, and Montana. I have to forget where I get the S, but probably not. And it's the deal where there's a satellite that you all have access to, or at least these three states do. And you can use it it's being used, for medical treatments to some extent. At least they're experimenting with it. If someone breaks a leg in an Eskimo village and they don't know how to handle it and they happen to have access to a television camera, they can beam the picture of the problem up over the satellite to a doctor somewhere in Seattle, for instance, and he can give them advice as to how to fix whatever the problem is. Now, that's just getting started, but that's the kind of thing that's happening. The emerging nations are very interested in that. Iran, for instance, is looking hard at trying to be able to develop systems like that. Also, paraprofessional medical training would take place over systems. Many other kinds of training would do that. Some of you were here last week, heard me talk about some of the things that we're doing in education with those kinds of things. We are going to have an abundance of communications channels if the economics change, though that's very important. We have to get a greater share of the gross national product into solving this. And if the delivery costs of this stuff get lower, and if the front-end costs of developing all the hardware and all the technology and all the software are met. And believe me, software really costs money. Whenever I look at developing a total course, a non-traditional course, I'm looking somewhere at $500,000 to $1 million to spend on a basic course in math. It's a lot of money that goes into these things to really do them right. And that's just the development. That's not the dissemination. So that stuff's expensive. The generation and development of the dissemination stuff is very expensive. Let me see. The concept of knowledge equity kept creeping back into this. And it was the ability for people who don't have access to the social system or to information or learning how to handle information to get into the process. That's a big problem, and many see that this, if used right, might be a way of doing that. But it would have to be a system such that whoever wants to get into it can get into it for almost nothing. Somebody brought up the idea of developing a system like food stamps for people who can't afford to get at educational and communication and knowledge things. It would have to be a better system than food stamps, they said, but at least, you know, something like that. And then that would be connected to a voucher system so that maybe the government would be financing a part of this, but the individual would be making the decision. That was one of the biggest things that came out of my group. We felt that there had to be several competitive systems so that people could make a choice rather than have the choice made for them by a governmental institution or someone else. That gets to a new idea, one I hadn't run into before, of the gatekeeper. A gatekeeper is a person who decides what goes on the system and who uses it. And that's, of course, a very powerful thing. Value systems really select what goes on and doesn't go on and who uses it. And nobody had any idea how to solve that except partially by putting a lot of things on and letting people have free access and make a choice. That's easy to say, but economically, I think that's almost impossible unless we put a lot more of our gross national product into it than I'm aware that we can do. Finally, down to power comes from information and communication and a few other things, but if you can tie up the information systems and the dollars, you got power. And probably the greatest fear of the whole conference, almost everyone, and some got up and walked out, they got so disturbed about this, was the fact that this can lead to dictatorship easier than anything else we got. A person that controls the military is pretty powerful, but they can always be overthrown. If you take over the information systems, you can probably tie everything up. But then, in order to prevent that, one has to get the people in power to allow people to have more access to information, and along with that comes the problems of revolutionary activities. And this is very easy to see in a South American country like Venezuela that I see a lot, because the more they let people have, and they've been doing this, the more likely there is for revolutionary activities, and that's why the military stands behind it and watches it and kind of slows her down every once in a while. And they have a very moderated way of doing it. It's a dangerous and sometimes seemingly almost impossible thing to do. Another new thought, another new issue that they came up with. Assuming that the receivers will go through the pain of getting the knowledge that's available, we've got to learn how to involve the user in the process of determining what knowledge they want and how to deliver it. If there is just a certain amount of stuff that you can get, then the user not only should have the choice of taking what's available, but also in developing what's going to be coming at them. There's a great danger of elitism, somewhat like a dictatorship coming on. That was another concern. There is an elitism to some extent in the people that generate and get the information out now. There's a new word I've heard, maybe I've just not been reading, but it was a thing called meritocracy, where the people who are utilitarian, that is, they can get out and get things done, but also intellectually oriented, to get a good combination, they're the kind of people that will be taking over things. And that sounds like it might be good, but there were many there that thought that would be a disaster too, because it's just another kind of dictatorship. There were a lot of media people there from the East Coast, and maybe some of you are from that business. I'm not very familiar with it, but they were very concerned about that because they tend to think it's already happened in their business. And when you study the way that the news is generated and programs are picked and things like that, they kind of feel that's already taken place. So, some solutions were suggested, and there was a lot of hope at the end of the thing. Most people there felt, and they'd been around a while, they're not people that haven't been wrapped around the system a few times. They said that the voucher system, the competing systems, spend more money on dissemination, really get people interested in using the system, let the marketplace decide and pay rather than put a tax on things. And they finally ended up by saying, we're not really testing any of the potential systems, and we've just got to do that. We've got to get out and build a set of systems that will allow the public to get involved and to learn how to make rational decisions. The conference seemed to say that we must give it a try, open up a huge, accessible, cheap, interactive communication system, teach adults discrimination skills, how to recognize bias, and decision-making skills. And their final concerns were back to, though, how we're going to keep each other from blowing up. And this is really my notes from the last day. They were all kind of summing up. These are kind of emotional words, but that's the kind of thing they were saying. How do we preserve and enhance our personal freedom? And most important to most everybody is how do we cut in the underserved and disenfranchised? And so they had a lot of ideas then along the things we were talking at the forum last night about getting involved with restructuring regulatory agencies and getting people involved in the process. Okay, that raised a lot of questions. Let me go back and sort of summarize them by, again, out of this magazine article, the problems. In one paragraph, they seem to capture it pretty well. And as I go through this, maybe you can pick out things you'd like to talk about. One, who will the gatekeepers be? Will authority be dispersed or concentrated? Will the multiplicity of channels provide a rich diversity of choice, or only seem to, like they do today? Who will decide what treasures are to be stored in the electronic archives available to your push buttons? Our whole history teaches us that these are very crucial questions, and most recent history confronts us with still further problems. Will the right of privacy survive the telecommunications revolution and the network of data banks? And for the moment, the questions remain unanswered and unanswerable. And the current focus is on hardware miracles rather than all these other questions floating around behind. And that may be one of the most serious things of all, because we might get so enamored with the things that you can use in your TV set this coming Christmas that you may forget about all the other things coming at you. And I'm not sure that I agree with that they are unanswered or unanswerable. They may be unanswered, but they may not be unanswerable. Okay, let's open it up for discussion. Yes, yes. A lot of psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right.
I can just see a whole bunch of isolated families. No. I mean, I'm trying to be presented to anyone and I can't go.
Mm-hmm.
But at least I have to get out of the house once a week to go up to the grocery store and to get out of my house to go to church, you know, and be around other people. I mean, I can just see, you know, if everything comes to the room and change,
right. Well, that's what that article said. People are messy and they like to do things their own way, and the guys that build these things like to make them work rather precisely. Although some of the people that have been non-technology people have been looking at ways of how to enhance the kind of problem that you had. People that are interested in shut-ins, as they call them, or acrophobics or whatever, to allow them to communicate better. You know, some of these new communications things may be able to handle those problems. Right. It's kind of fun to talk back. We've got some devices now that you can talk back to, and that you can control. If you don't like what they say, you can really get at them. You know, that's kind of fun too. Yes, sir. Yeah. Right. Right. You don't know what those black lines mean. I don't. I don't have the slightest idea what they mean. Yeah. And I guess what these scenarios are is that you would be ordering by looking at things coming through a screen, like a catalog. And you really have to trust these systems, too. If you want to check them out, you have to spend, it's like with your bank balance now. They're making that easier, I guess. We have an improvement in ours. Yes, sir. It's there. Yep, it's there. Right. Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. And that's where this conference came out, is let's try everything and really ram it through and get the money and go out and politic for it and all that stuff. In fact, if we don't, we're really in trouble. Right. Yes, sir. Yes, there are. Yes.
If all the technology is, you know, if you're forced to use that, if that's the only system in which you can communicate, it's tremendous, and you use it.
Fantastic. There's yeah.
If you don't have to use it, I mean, there's just no one that chooses to do that. You know, by choice, if they have the other means available to them, and I'm just really worried that if you apply that on a large scale, when people start using then I think there's, like the discussion this morning, there becomes all kinds of problems. We don't know what the long-term implications of those are. And I think, in particular, the
There's a guy I know of in Calgary, Canada, who has hooked up a system like you're talking about. He uses some sort of a device that concentrates on the pupils of the eye of a quadriplegic, and he can command one of these new television or new computer terminals to do anything that he wants it to do. And now he's taking college courses at the University of Illinois over their system, and that's the only thing he can move. With every new invention, there's a lot of bad stuff too. Dave? Wow. Oh, yeah.
Doctors and say, what do we do to use it? And I think that's great that they're willing to do that. And it's just interesting that society chooses to put its investment in value into the other products. See, the other is just an afterthought after the capital of technology rather than just.
They're looking at this as the people that put the people on the moon are now looking at this as their next frontier. And since we have that large organization, let's turn it around and go charging off with another large government bureaucracy to run it. That's scary. Yes. Well, the decision makers and companies aren't aware of all this yet. That's one of the problems. Not my company. I doubt. The reason I wrote this is so I can get this information out and around. So it's serious. This is serious stuff. Up until now, people read it in journals, and they, you know. But now, when their organization is being set up to do this, that will happen. I think, you know, because it'll be cheaper to do it that way, for instance. One of the things that we're doing in our educational things, I used to do what Xerox did. They built a huge center that we were at, and it now, to me, that's a dinosaur. That thing's absolutely unusable. And it did the same thing there that you're talking about. It was in Leesburg, Virginia. They dumped this huge thing and used up all kinds of land for something that now they're trying to figure out what to do with, because it's uneconomical for people to come there. We're putting, for our employees and for other purposes, learning centers all over the country. And so we're distributing the information and education to them rather than bringing them to some huge thing that uses a lot of land.
The message I'd like you then to go ahead and give to these companies is it ought to be demonstrated in their own companies.
Yes.
In terms of exactly the kind of problem that somehow in the way those companies and the industries are behaving, that they will indeed, their behavior will contribute to better human relationships, more the kinds of concerns that you had, more neighborhood industries and stuff like this, before they start selling it to our school systems and installing it in our homes and all of that stuff. I think that message is that they have to show their credibility, because it's too easy for high technology to become tremendously subsidized, like, for example, the television.
Mm-hmm.
The television is subsidized with sales tax. You call it advertising, higher price, but it's a sales tax. It is. You don't have to pay it.
You sound like somebody from an emerging nation. They use that criterion on companies when they come in. They look you over very carefully, and if you're not using what you're asking them to do, they'll just walk off. And that's a very important criterion. A lot of people have learned that. Not enough. Well, I don't know what, you know. Well, the facilities guys in a company that build those things, they really don't talk to the engineers and don't keep track of those things. They don't not yet have that, I think. Yes. Right. Oh, it would be a terrible waste of space, yeah. In fact, we've been doing that all over the country. That's one of the biggest criticisms of the educational business. But, of course, this stuff isn't really available yet, but it's going to be a chicken and an egg. People are going to have to do what you said and make the decision and force it to happen, or because the people who manufacture optical fibers aren't going to. We decided, my company, to just go out and make a system and do it ourselves, because if we didn't do it, nobody else would. So we did it, now other people are getting interested in it, and before long there'll be a worldwide network of several different kinds over which you can have choices to do things. But yeah, I agree. But I don't think that the capability to do it yet in companies, some of the management structure is there yet. That's an educational process. Yes, sir? Yes. Well, you have other pressures too. Mm-hmm. Sure. They may very well have access to what makes it even worse, I think, is that they may have access to the information and understand it and still go off and do something that to us seems to be a bad decision, right, because of the other pressures. And that's because of usually some small lobbying group, I think. That's a bias I have, anyway. That's the panacea of this whole thing, that we get the further out hardware people, they say, well, sure, you just build a thing where everybody can get the information and vote on all these issues, and that begs a lot of this stuff, this receiver stuff. That's a terrible problem. That really is a big problem. Yes, sir?
Yeah. You didn't say that.
Right. Right. Particularly with automation of the manufacturing jobs. Yes. For instance, in our country, well, just like they were studying it back in the 40s, they felt that back in the 40s, I remember when I was in college, I had to read all these wild papers about everybody was going to have nothing to do. But as the service businesses are growing more rapidly, then we can get people displaced and trained over to do them. Interesting thing that I just discovered in our company, we build very large computers. I can't remember the numbers, but I think at one time it took about 15,000 people to build a certain number of computers. And we've been able to work that down to a point where there are now 8,000 half doing the same bigger job. Now, as we did that, we had a program to retrain people and move them into new jobs. Not one of those persons was fired because of that change. Some left to go to other jobs and back to school. But they all ended up in, and we followed this somewhat closely just to see what would happen. It was very carefully done, took about 10 years, and all of those people are into something that, in fact, is usually a higher level, more enhancing job. A lot of companies do this. General Electric has done things like that as they move from one program to another. That's a tough one. Yeah, that's hard. And that's getting increasingly hard. People just are refusing to move. That's another thing. I don't know if that's quite... I'm not in personnel anymore, but a couple of years ago, you know, everybody move anywhere you want them to go, just get them on a bus and go. And all of a sudden, boom, everybody said, I'm not going to move anymore. It wasn't quite that dramatic. It seemed that way to me. But and I think that's still here. People don't like to move. Yeah, that's right. A lot of my work is going to be done in my home from now on. I have a terminal that I'm putting in the basement, in a room, and I can communicate with anybody that I want to that I have to see, and I can ask him questions. If he's not there, I leave a message for him. He goes back and forth. I really don't have to go to the office anymore. In fact, I don't like to because of the phone. On this terminal, I can choose whether or not I want to talk to somebody because I can see who it is that's calling me. But at work, I can't because unless my secretary screens out the call, which sometimes she doesn't understand, then I'm stuck with something I don't want to talk about. That's one of the improvements in the system, by the way, as far as I'm concerned. It's like Holden. No one can get a hold of you up here. I love that. Yes, sir. Yes, very serious problem. I don't know. Don't know. No, in education particularly, we have so many people. Even in underdeveloped countries, like India, where they really need teachers, they have people that are overtrained. They have PhDs, and they need elementary school teachers, and the PhDs don't want to teach reading. They're having a terrible problem with that. And they're building more and more schools to train people to get higher and higher levels of education. That doesn't make sense either. But not many of these things do. Our social systems don't really react that fast. Well, anyway, that's a look at how a large number of people who come from all walks of life looked at this thing, and all they did was raise issues. Oh, by the way, one of the things that may happen, they're going to take all of the videotapes that were put together and all of the information, they're going to condense them down, and there will be some, I think some things on, some of them will be presented on national public television and maybe NBC, ABC later on this fall. You might look for that because I think that would really be fascinating. There were some fantastic personalities there. The people that they brought in were really, and they emerged from extremely conservative that I don't even want to move and let's go backwards to guys that can't get there fast enough, and they had some good conversation. They will be available to schools and any other organization. I'm sure the National Science Foundation spent several $1 million on this thing, and they've been criticized, and so they're going to get out and make it used so they can go back to Congress and say, hey, it really worked. So I'm sure you'll hear a lot more about this. Especially if you're in the education business. I'm going to use them myself, personally. Okay. Time to eat. Thank you very much.